Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Labor has had a strong start to the year with a good lead in the polls. But it's been lucky. Much of its advantage has come because of the government's own goals. Even Bill Shorten's critics concede that he's done better than expected by many in the leadership. But the government likes to goad Anthony Albanese at every opportunity as the alternative who's there in the wings. And he's our guest today. Anthony Albanese, these government jibes about you being a possible replacement to Bill Shorten are flattering, but are they damaging to either you or to Labor?
Well, Labor's getting on with the job of being an effective opposition, I think holding the government to account, but also putting forward alternative policies. I'm focused on being a member of Bill Shorten's team, and I think it's very clear that Labor's united in campaigning to get rid of this government. It's the government parties that have internal issues, that have issues between the Liberal Party and the National Party, as we've seen this week, over the preferences for One Nation. And I think the government, I think, more divided than I've seen a political party for a very long time. And I've seen a bit of division.
That's a big call, remembering the Labor years.
It certainly is a big call, but very clearly, Tony Abbott and his forces out there campaigning for Tony's return. You've had this week too, quite extraordinary, the Prime Minister's office, essentially, as you well know, because you broke the story, leaking against effectively the Treasurer and undermining him. So I think the other side of politics are very divided. We have, I think, a unity of purpose.
Let's turn to your shadow area of infrastructure. Now, everyone appreciates the importance of infrastructure, but it's easy to get lost in the detail. Just in broad overall terms, how much difference is there between the government and the opposition in this area? Is it a matter of how much would be spent or invested, or is it detail over the projects?
Well, I think it's the significant difference between the parties that we can see now. Firstly, in terms of processes, we established Infrastructure Australia to recommend the right projects to the government that would provide the biggest economic boost. We've seen the government effectively walk away from that strategy and remove funding from projects that had been approved by Infrastructure Australia, particularly public transport projects like Melbourne Metro and the Cross River Rail project in Brisbane. And what we've seen is from the government also is a reduction in investment. They, for each of the 12 quarters that they've been in government, the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows that each of their 12 quarters has been less investment in terms of public sector infrastructure investment than every single one of the 21 quarters when we were in government, from June 2008, from the time of our first budget, through to September 2013. So I think that is a really stark contrast. So it's the nature of the investment, but also the size of the investment. And then I think effectively one of the big differences, we funded public transport projects. Tony Abbott removed the funding. Malcolm Turnbull likes riding on trains and taking selfies, but he hasn't funded any new public transport projects. So the nature of the investment as well has changed.
Now, infrastructure is one of the issues in the West Australian election. Will you be campaigning there between now and that election? I know you've already been there. And what's your prediction about the outcome?
Well, I've been there and I'll be back because infrastructure is a big issue in the WA election. I think we have a good Labor story to tell about the projects that We funded, when I was the minister, the largest ever roads project in Perth, Gateway WA, the Great Eastern Highway upgrades, the upgrades to the Great Northern Highway, the Esperance Port Access Road, Bunbury road upgrade, and of course in terms of public transport, the Perth CityLink project. That's a really exciting urban project to unite Perth CBD with the Northbridge Entertainment Precinct. So all of those projects, I think, stand in stark contrast with what we've seen from this government, which has essentially been two-pronged. One, to try and claim projects as theirs that were already funded and already underway in some cases, like Gateway WA, or projects like the Swan Valley Bypass, where they changed the name to the NorthLink project. But having a new name doesn't make it a new road or a new project. It was already funded. It was funded by us in the 2013 budget. And there hasn't been effectively, apart from that, the only new project that they've had is Perth Freight Link that hasn't really begun construction. They've begun land clearing through the Beeliar wetlands. And this is a project that is a dud. It's a project that stops 3 kilometres short of the Fremantle port. So it doesn't take the freight to the port. It takes it to near the port, and then you'll have all of the roads through the communities. And secondly, Fremantle port is almost at full capacity. It'll be reached early in the next decade. The real issue in terms of planning is how we plan for the outer harbour south of Fremantle, and that planning work is vital. The government's not doing anything about that, nor is the federal government doing anything to support the state government's expansion of public transport that's essential. So Mark McGowan has, I think, quite an exciting plan for Perth Metronet, which is essentially about the expansion of the rail network, the removal of level crossings, new stations. That's what's required. And all of our cities have something in common. They're all suffering increasingly from urban congestion. Infrastructure Australia says that the cost of urban congestion, if unaddressed to the national economy, will be some $53 billion by the year 2031. So that should be a major priority for the federal government to engage with states and territories on, and we're not seeing that. And they're also, of course, threatening that if the Labor government of Mark McGowan, if he's elected, doesn't proceed with Perth Freightlink, then they'll take that $1.2 billion that they've offered to the WA government for the Freightlink project off the table. That is, they'll punish the voters of Western Australia for having the temerity to vote Labor.
Now, just on the outcome of that election, what's your prediction?
I'm very hopeful that Mark McGowan will be elected. It appears to me, having been a regular visitor to the West, I've travelled there 6 times over the last year, and pretty consistently I've been a visitor there probably every couple of months for many, many years now. You've seen a real change in the mood. I think people in WA know that they had this big resources boom and they haven't got much to show for it. Colin Barnett's government has lost its AAA credit rating. The deficit has gone through the roof. You have a slowing of economic growth, high youth unemployment, a failure to invest essentially in the people through skills or in major infrastructure apart from the federally funded major infrastructure projects. So I think Colin Barnett is really out of time, and I think the out of ideas as well. And I believe that the deal to give One Nation preferences, even ahead of the National Party, is a real sign of desperation from Colin Barnett, and I think it'll backfire.
Now, that'll be an early test, that election of One Nation's vote. We hear a lot about it taking votes from the conservative side of politics, but how much do you think One Nation is a threat to Labor in terms of votes, not just or particularly in the West, but more generally, and especially in the coming Queensland election?
Well, One Nation are appealing to a base of voters with simplistic solutions, and I think they will be similar to the way that fringe parties of the right have been found out in the past, that when people actually look at what they do and what their impact is, what way they actually vote in the parliament, then we've seen One Nation rise before and disappear. We've seen the Palmer United Party at the last federal election rise and then disappear. And it will be interesting to see what happens with One Nation. People will also look at some of their candidates. I mean, some of the candidates in Western Australia who've advocated some quite extraordinary propositions, attacked single mothers as not being able to hang on to their husbands, attacked the children of single parents as well. The revelations today about someone essentially calling for the killing of Indonesians, the statements about people who happen to be gay or lesbian, the sort of terms that have been used of abuse by some of their candidates, I think will put people off as well. It's important that political parties take these views seriously, and we'll wait and see where One Nation are at in a couple of years' time. The appeal of someone, whether of the left or the right, who says, here's the solution, if you vote for me, your lives will all be better, needs to be tested by reality. And I think when it's tested by reality, the One Nation agenda doesn't stack up. And frankly, it is disappointing that under Malcolm Turnbull, unlike under John Howard, who in a principled fashion rejected One Nation, failed to embrace them into the mainstream by saying that he would put One Nation last in every seat, it is a pity that with Colin Barnett's position and with the crab walking over to One Nation that we've seen from people like Arthur Sinodinos, arguing that somehow their views are more sophisticated, well, the sort of views that we've had put forward by the candidates are anything but sophisticated.
And what about that other minor party, small party threat, the Greens? They're strong in your seat and a real risk in a couple of seats in Melbourne. Will they be, do you think, stronger or weaker at the next election than they were last time?
I think they're struggling with their identity of whether they're a protest party and a movement, if you like, which is the view of many in the New South Wales Greens, or whether they're a parliamentary party and how change comes about. During the election campaign, the views of the candidate who ran against me, Jim Casey, were put out there very clearly when I think he said to a forum put up on the website by the Greens, it wasn't something that we stumbled upon, so they put it up quite proudly, him saying that if it was a choice between a Bill Shorten-led Labor government or a government led by Tony Abbott with people on the streets protesting about land rights, climate change and other issues, then he'd rather have a Tony Abbott government with those protests happening than a Bill Shorten-led government without those protests. And that said it all. For many in the Greens, the protest is the end in itself. And they have a it's a sophisticated view, I guess, that says that that is how people are politicised and how, from their perspective of wanting revolutionary, if you like, rather than reformist change, you need that momentum from the bottom and from social movements. Essentially, I'm about making a difference to people's lives and making lives better. That's why I'm in politics. And that stands in stark contrast to many in the Greens who advocate that sort of view. And you're seeing that tension now come out very publicly with the formation of the Left Renewal faction, committed to overtly to the overthrow of capitalism and revolutionary change, that being dismissed by people like Bob Brown and Christine Milne, essentially saying to those people that they should leave the Greens political party and go back to essentially the parties where they came from. I mean, many of these people were formerly members of the Socialist Party of Australia, the Communist Party, the International Socialist Organisation, or the Socialist Labor League. At each of the last three elections, the candidates against me have been former members of revolutionary Marxist parties. And they haven't essentially changed their views. They've just changed their vehicle. And they see the Greens as a vehicle in which they'll have more legitimacy and able to advance those views and get more support. That's been called out, not just by people in the Labor Party, but by Bob Brown in particular. And it's very clear to me that that tension which is there, I see it at local government level, I see it at local branch level. We've seen it with state pre-selections in New South Wales. And that ongoing tension that's there is, I think, meaning that certainly any momentum that the Greens thought that they would have has certainly dissipated.
Do you think that Labor needs to at all change its tactics in handling the Greens, and do you think it would ever be possible that Federal Labor would again have an alliance in government with the Greens? Don't mean a coalition, of course, but you did have an alliance last time.
Well, people have to deal with the parliament that is elected. But what I would not be in favour of is any formal agreement between Labor and other political parties. My view is that if the Greens wanted to vote for a minor, a coalition government rather than a Labor government, then that would be up to them.
Is this with hindsight? Did you feel at the time that agreement was not a good idea?
Well, I wasn't a party to the agreement.
No, but you were a senior member of the government.
Yeah, absolutely. And we came to arrangements with not just the Greens member, but with Rob Oakeshott and Tony Windsor for confidence and supply. And I think the optics, certainly, of the signing of the statement were, I think, not in Labor's to Labor's advantage. They enabled the coalition to speak about an agreement that wasn't really there. I mean, I dealt with legislation before the parliament, and there was no certainty of what way the Greens would vote on any of that legislation, except for supply bills, and of course, we don't deny supply to the coalition government either. That doesn't mean we have an agreement with them. And indeed, when we had the change and I became Deputy Prime Minister under Kevin Rudd, that night, on the Wednesday night, we had a meeting with the Greens leadership. We put to them that the change had happened. They asked, what would happen in terms of the next day? What were we offering them to guarantee that they would vote for confidence? And we said nothing. That's a choice for you. If you want to tomorrow on the floor of the parliament say that you don't support confidence in the government and vote with Tony Abbott for a no confidence motion, that's a decision for you. And they, of course, didn't do that. And in the end, Tony Abbott didn't pursue it. But I think that on some issues, we agree with the Greens, a political party. On some issues, we agree with the coalition or with minor parties. My view of dealing with people who aren't in the Labor Party is pretty consistent. Treat them with respect. Engage with them in a constructive way, and that way you will get, I think, better outcomes than if you just engage in abuse or assumptions. And we effectively got through 595 pieces of legislation. Many of those were with the support of Bob Katter, who we certainly didn't have an agreement with, or Peter Slipper, other people who didn't have guarantees of confidence or supply, but we managed to get our legislation through that parliament far more effectively, it must be said, than the current government's managed to do under either Tony Abbott or Malcolm Turnbull.
Now, we're a long way still from an election, although you wouldn't think so if you listen to the politicians on both sides. But do you believe that the opposition will go to the next election with basically the same bag of policies, or will there be a big overhaul?
Well, I think we've got a foundation of policies. We certainly aren't starting from scratch. We have also very strong philosophical commitments that show where we're coming from, and that I think is part of our success, that we've managed to judge the legislation that's before the parliament on the basis of our values, and those Labor values of having a strong economy, but an economy that puts people back into the equation, that acknowledges that it's not separate from distributional issues and giving people opportunity. So, there's a reason why the Australian National Anthem is Advance Australia Fair, and I think fairness is something that will go right across our policy objectives. I think on a range of issues, we were rewarded with support for being prepared to be bold, particularly the negative gearing and capital gains tax changes aimed at improving housing affordability. I think on infrastructure, it's pretty clear in my portfolio what values we have of building productivity, creating economic growth through investing in infrastructure, including making sure that we prepare the national economy for the future. And that means fibre, not copper, when it comes to broadband. That means investing in public transport, not just roads. That means dealing with how our cities function. That means dealing with the challenge of climate change. All of those views mean that because the Labor Party has had considerable discussion on specific issues, but also on general directions, it means, I think, that by the time of the next election, the people who are voting will have a very clear idea of the sort of government that they'd be voting for.
Let me take up a social issue. You've been to the forefront in the battle to get same-sex marriage, but as I understand it, you want to retain the conscience vote for Labor MPs, even though the Labor platform now is to have a binding vote beyond the next election. Why do you think keeping the conscience vote is really important?
Look, I've supported the conscience vote for a considerable period of time on a range of issues where essentially people are in a position whereby they believe that they have to choose between their loyalty to their party and their loyalty to their faith. And it is my view that in arguing for a more tolerant Australia, one that recognises diversity and one that respects difference, then you advance that cause by saying and doing it as well in the way that you put in place your decision-making processes. Now, I'm a strong supporter of marriage equality. I'm the first person in the history of the House of Representatives to ever move a private member's bill about giving equality for same-sex couples. That applied in my first term. I did that on the issue of superannuation. When it comes to marriage, for some people who regard marriage as having essentially nothing to do with the state or civil society, regard it as being sacred, something ordained by their God, then in terms of that view that they have, then I can disagree with that strongly, but acknowledge that that is a genuine view that they hold. And I believe over a period of time that people need to be willing to accept that people have different views and that history progresses. I think one of my criticisms of a lot of the traditional left is they tend to romanticise the past, the good old days when everything was progressive, and it simply doesn't stack up to history. The fact is that, you know, we had a white Australia policy in this country for a long time when it comes to race.
And in your party.
And in the Labor Party, as one of our founding planks, indeed, we had in terms of giving recognition of Indigenous people. We were so far behind for most of the time since 1788. When it comes to people granting, removing discrimination on the basis of sexuality, when I moved my private members bill in 1998 to just, it was just about superannuation, that was seen as a radical move. We removed some discrimination from almost 100 pieces of legislation in the first term of the Rudd government, for migration, health, social security, across a range of areas of the law. And that ended up not creating any fuss at all. And there is outstanding discrimination there when it comes to marriage equality. It needs to happen. And when it does happen, I think people will wonder what the fuss was about. But that's happened because of being prepared to discuss and debate these issues through. Even in this parliament, over the last few years, you've seen one by one people who previously were opposed to marriage equality change their mind. So the right side of history is very clear on this. Occasionally, you get a rise of bigotry, whether it be on the basis of sexuality, gender, race, religion. But I have great faith in humanity and moving forward, and I'm absolutely certain that marriage equality will happen. It's a matter of how you make that happen and bringing society, as many people as possible, forward with you. And I think that may well be more difficult if you have a perception that people are being forced to vote one way or the other. And I think the tragedy is that there's now a majority in the Parliament right now, in the House of Representatives and the Senate, who want marriage equality, and Tony Abbott won't let people vote.
Now, you have previously been Leader of the House. You've previously been Manager of Opposition Business. It does seem that question times become much more caustic of late, much more bitter. How do you think voters respond to the tenor of debate that we now see?
I think they respond badly. And I think some of that is a distortion, the fact that they don't see some of the better elements. The TVs don't think it's interesting to show people agreeing. They will tend to show the conflict that's there. And, of course, a whole range of legislation passes the Parliament with everyone in agreement. So I think that is something that we have to be conscious of as parliamentarians in how we debate each other. And I think, from time to time, we're all guilty of transgressions when it comes to behaviour and arguing on the floor of the Parliament, perhaps more stridently than we should. But then again, Parliament's about a battle of ideas. It's serious. We're determining the laws of the nation and the future of this great country. So a bit of passion doesn't hurt, but I think it's important that the tone of the debate, I would like to think we all need to do better in making it less personality driven.
But just to finish on what has always seemed to me a very obvious question, if voters don't like it when politicians behave badly, why don't politicians in fact behave better?
Well, I think human beings are imperfect. And the truth is that when...
I don't have many neighbours who behave like that.
That's true. But let me say, from time to time, organisations that I've been in that aren't political, sporting organisations and such, can have some pretty good blues as well in terms of conflict. But the nature of our Westminster process is adversarial as well, by definition, from time to time. I actually think that parliamentarians, ministers, for example, when they answer a Dorothy Dixer from their own side and actually stick to the policy and don't have a crack at the other side, can be incredibly effective. I used to say that to ministers when I was Leader of the House.
Did they listen?
And sometimes they did. And I think some of the best answers in the Parliament from the current government have been people who are putting forward ideas, informing the public, speaking about the national interest, and that can be a very positive thing.
Well, we'll see what they're like in a couple of hours. Anthony Albanese, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for this time. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again with you soon. Goodbye for now.